This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Yep, we're off to see The Wizard today. The film version of The Wizard of Oz turns 80 this year, but its mesmerizing visuals, hit musical numbers, and heartwarming characters are still charming audiences today. On this edition of Movies on the Radio, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys are here to talk about your memories and favorite moments from the film. And later in the show, we're going to talk with an expert on the book that inspired the film, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and its author, L. Frank Baum. Marcia Gordon's a professor of film at North Carolina State University and a fellow at the National Humanities Center. Laura Boys, film curator for the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
This is kind of, it really is an incredible film that was very popular when it came out in 1939 and still so today. What do you think accounts for this enduring legacy, as we might say?
So my favorite book about the movie The Wizard of Oz is written by Salman Rushdie for the British Film Institute. And what he points out is that it's a film whose driving force is the inadequacy of adults, even well-meaning adults who can't keep Toto from being killed. And so it's a movie that it encourages children to find their own destiny and take control of their lives. And it's also a movie without a male hero, which is also extremely unusual for the time.
Yeah.
So it allows all kinds of people to visualize themselves as someone who's having this adventure.
Yeah, and I would point out a couple other things. One is this was not the first film version of The Wizard of Oz. It had been made many times before that, starting in the early 1900s, some very short versions of it. And also that even though this was a very successful version of the film, MGM spent so much money making and marketing this film that it did not turn a profit on its release. It was only after later re-releases in the 1940s and 1950s, especially as Judy Garland became more and more famous, that it actually turned a profit.
Yeah, even though it made a lot of money.
Exactly.
Right? Six Academy Award nominations, I think it won two. So it was a popular film, but it needed to make more than $3 million, and I think a lot more than $3 million.
But it wasn't a cult film kind of the way it is now. When Frank Morgan, who played the Wizard and Professor Marvel and all these other roles, died, it was not even mentioned in his obituary in 1949.
Interesting.
Because it wasn't considered to be, you know, that kind of a cinematic landmark.
Well, it has become that since, and here's what some of our listeners had to say about it.
Chris Ford from Edenton, North Carolina. I was about 5 years old the first time I really remember watching The Wizard of Oz. So I remember being just completely enthralled, sitting on the living room floor in front of the TV. I was all alone. The rest of the family was off somewhere, I don't know. I was oblivious to everything else except the movie. So oblivious, turns out, that I didn't notice fire trucks had pulled into our yard. A neighbor had seen some flames coming from the chimney and called the fire department. Fire trucks came, lights, sirens going, the whole nine yards, and seemed like half the town of Wake Forest had come with them, and they were all on the front lawn with my family watching the spectacle. Realizing I wasn't with them, my mother came looking for me. She found me glued to that spot in the living room watching the TV, and she asked, "Chris, do you know what's happening?" And I replied, "Yeah, the witch just melted."
"How about a little fire, Scarecrow?" "It's burning! Help! Go through that water!" "You cursed rat! Look what you've done!
So after explaining that the chimney that was like on the fireplace right beside me had caught fire, she turned the TV off. We went outside. Fire had been extinguished. No damage to the roof or the rest of the house, which is great. But I didn't see the end of the movie. I had to wait a whole year for The Wizard of Oz to come on TV again, because it was 1978 and we didn't have a VCR.
Here we go. Chris Ford, his memories of watching The Wizard of Oz.
That is an awesome story, not to be topped, I suspect. But, I mean, I will say that this raises something about what is so powerful about The Wizard of Oz, which is it's so engrossing, partly because I think all the quests that are in it, right? And so the structure of the film, that first it's like, I have to save Toto. And by the end, it's like, I have to go home. I have to find the wizard. I have to do the, like, there are so many things that make you want to see what's going to happen next that, that in a weird way, this is a completely logical story.
Well, it's the magic of the movies when you have that out of body experience. It's what we're all looking for when we go to the theater.
Even on your little television in your house.
Well, that's what I mean. It speaks to something else, because the special effects that were done for a 1939 movie held up well enough for a kid in 1978 and well beyond to stay glued to the set while the house is burning down.
I think when you watch and when you really just think about the special effects in The Wizard of Oz and you compare them to maybe special effects in films 10 or 15 years ago, in many ways, I think the 1939 film holds up much better than more recent.
I love a practical special effect.
Me too.
Yeah. The great tornadoes and lots of burning scarecrows. Many, many more. And lots of listeners had a lot of different ways in and different ways of remembering this film.
Hi, I'm Laura Jennings from Kill Devil Hills. And I've just been watching The Wizard of Oz for many years. And I've always enjoyed the story and just all the messages that have been in the movie. You know, how she's finds, you know, new friends along the way. And, you know, nothing really fazes Dorothy.
I don't like this forest. It's dark and creepy.
Of course, I don't know, but I think it'll get darker before it gets lighter.
Do you suppose we'll meet any wild animals?
We might. Animals that eat straw?
Some, but mostly lions and tigers and bears.
Lions?
And tigers?
And bears.
Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
When I did go and see it this January with the 80th anniversary in the theaters, I was very excited because I'd never seen it in a theater, and it was just going to be just something I didn't think I'd ever see again. So a girlfriend and I went, and it was being able to sit through the whole thing and also pick up things that you kind of missed or really forgotten about.
There we go, Laura Jennings from Kill Devil Hills.
It's certainly a movie that every time you watch it, you see something different in it, no matter how many times you've seen it.
Well, and there's something to be said when you go to see it in a theater and you're not, I mean, I remember we used to always pop popcorn. You know, we had a lot of things going on when I watched it on television as a kid, right? And you can't pause it. You can't, you know, you are getting distracted from it. So to get to see it in a theatrical setting is very special.
Yeah, I've never seen it. And it never occurred to me that it was a movie. You know, I'd always seen it on TV and
right.
I thought to myself, and it was a black and white TV. So I never had the
thrill. But we have to mention that in particular, that for many of us, we didn't realize that The Land of Oz was in color until we were much, much older.
Yeah. And it didn't matter. I mean, it didn't seem to matter. Let's move on now and let's hear what Steve Goldstein has to say.
Hi, this is Stephen Goldstein. I'm calling from Asheville, North Carolina. I was born in 1948 in Fort Wayne, Indiana, so The Wizard of Oz was already pretty much an oldie by the time I was allowed to see movies. The much-anticipated annual broadcast ran for quite a few years when I was a kid who didn't fully appreciate the subtleties of the story. Nonetheless, I was mesmerized by it. We watched every year on our 21-inch Magnavox black-and-white TV. Among other things, you couldn't appreciate the fact that everything was in color after Dorothy gets bonked on the head. Eventually, we got a color TV, and I found out about the lush coloration of the whole middle of the movie. In 1971, I moved to London, and in 1972, the British Film Institute sponsored a showing in the theater at South Bank. I convinced many of my work friends and housemates, none of whom was American and none of whom had ever seen the film, even on TV, to attend with me. Some were skeptical since it had the appearance of being a kiddie movie, but I sold them on it and they agreed to come. We partook of some weed at the beginning, sat fairly close to the front of the wonderful theater that they showed it in, and I was blown away, as were all my friends. Prior to seeing it on the widescreen, I had loved the movie for years, but it became positively breathtaking finally seeing it in large format 33 years after it was released. To this day, it remains one of my all-time favorites.
The Wizard of Oz at 80 today in the state of things.
Well, and I do think that that's an important part of this history that we need to mention, especially for people who are young enough to have not grown up watching this on television, that it was first aired in the 1950s by CBS, and that's how it became the cult film that it is today, that people tuned in and watched it every time that it was on. Before, you could just play it on your VHS tape. I mean, it's kind of, you can track the people who watched it on VHS, who watched it on DVD, who watched it on Blu-ray, who watched it on television, and this is one of the phenomena of the film.
The first time I saw it in a theater, I was in college, and we're talking about the special effects. I could not believe how convincing the tornado was in a theater.
Yeah, that was
really
always
amazing.
Scary. I mean, I still have that. That's my tornado nightmare. I actually see that one. I mean, it's so vivid. And, of course, again, I think it often came out, was aired during the holidays, because it seemed to me, I associated with the American Airlines Christmas party. Santa Claus would land, my dad worked for American, and the Santa Claus would land in a helicopter and then give us all a toy and lots of free ice cream. And then you'd go home, and every year the Wizard of Oz seemed to be on after that. So, that's why I love the Wizard of Oz. Movies on the radio today. It's the Wizard of Oz at 80. Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon and you just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.
Gosh, it would be awful pleasing to reason out the reason for things I can't explain. Then perhaps I'll deserve you and be even worthy of you if I only had a brain.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, celebrating the 80th anniversary of the film The Wizard of Oz on Movies on the Radio with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys. And before we get into any more of our listeners, we should listen to this one. This is somebody who just recently saw The Wizard of Oz for the first time.
Hello, my name is Stefan Hobbs. I'm calling from Denver, Colorado. I'm 29 years old, and I watched The Wizard of Oz for the first time less than 24 hours ago. It was an interesting feeling watching something that's so renowned and so old for the very first time in my life, hearing a lot of the things that you would hear throughout your life, like the different songs that are so well-known, seeing the characters that are so well-known, hearing lines like, I'll get you my pretty and your little dog too, for the first time, and also imagining what that would be like for someone seeing it for the first time when it was first released. And I imagine that is something that was such a big deal, being that Technicolor was just recently invented. But I overall really enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed it a little more than I thought that I would. Just the story and the characters, it's a very sweet movie, very charming. But yeah, overall, just seeing something like that for the first time was an interesting feeling that's been on my mind since I watched it.
Stephen Hobbs.
I am always surprised when I teach this film at NC State how many of my students now have not seen it. Because there was a time where if you would have asked, you know, a room full of freshmen or sophomores, have you seen The Wizard of Oz before? It would have been 100% of hands going up. Now it's 50%. And yet what's so interesting, as Stefan was pointing out, is like, they know the ruby slippers. They know some of these lines. These are part of the fabric of our culture, and how they get to people who haven't seen it is another thing altogether.
Well, it's the American fairy tale. And even if you don't read fairy tale books, I mean, you certainly know the iconography of those kinds of stories.
Yeah, and certainly so many, as you say, so many of the moments in the film are baked into our culture, even though we don't. I mean, it's like quoting Shakespeare, and then you see the play and say, oh, that's where that came from.
Right.
You know, I've been saying that all my life. So what do you think, what was it like for you watching it for the first time, Laura?
Well, I was probably already deeply involved in the movies, as probably Marcia was as well.
Yeah.
And it just seems to be an expansion of that old movie universe that, of course, was going to take over my whole life eventually.
Yeah, and I mean, I couldn't tell you how old I was when I first saw it. I was very young and we watched it on the television every time it came on. But I will say this, I never, after the first time, watched that flying monkey scene. I would close my eyes and put my hands over my ears, and my parents would tell me when it was over because I did not want to see those flying monkeys. They were so horrifying to me.
They scared me. I mean, I liked it because it was scary, and I didn't think horror was scary enough, and you could certainly never see scary enough stuff for me on TV, and this did it. I was that close to closing my eyes. And the music.
And they're so violent. I mean, they light the scarecrow on fire. Yeah. They put Toto in a basket just like the evil Margaret Hamilton in the beginning. So,
And I may have told this story on the air before, but the last time I watched the movie, I said, oh, wait a minute, those aren't really monkeys. Those are people in monkey costumes. And so I called up my daughter, and she said, wait, what? They're not really monkeys? And then I called up my mother, and she said, wait, what? They're not really monkeys?
She just hung up, right? She just hung up.
because it's like, well, you know, they're looking at the witch, and then they're looking, you know, obviously they're taking their cues, but I really thought they were monkeys up until about 3 years ago.
No, and apparently the tornado was the most expensive effect. They had to figure out how to do that with gauze and a gantry.
Muslin and super complicated and incredibly effective. I mean, just looks so integrated
into
the movie.
And Technicolor was new. Was this the first time it was used?
No, not the first time by any stretch, but I would say the most magnificent and the most self-aware to take your audience from a world of really more sepia than black and white to full color in all of its glory, and to do that within the world of the film was just simply brilliant.
Which made it very expensive, and I'm just coming to this for the first time. 1939, Depression is, you know, been going on for a decade, and you're making one of the most expensive films that MGM had made in a while. As you say, they didn't recoup all of it until much later. That was a big risk. And knowing that a lot of the audience is going to be paying 5 cents and not 10 cents to get in because they're kids, right?
That's right. And that was one of the marketing challenges, is how to convince adults to go because they needed the higher ticket prices.
But then at the same time, I mean, Shirley Temple was the number one box office star for so many years in the 30s. So clearly people would go see more child-oriented films with the family.
And she was a top pick to play Dorothy when they were casting the film.
Yeah,
but Fox wouldn't lend her, because she was too valuable
as a Fox commodity, not an MGM commodity.
Well, the casting, I mean, the stories about this abound. You talk about casting, you know, the Buddy Ebsen was going to play the Scarecrow initially. He moves to the Tin Man because Ray Bolger, fascinating story, Ray Bolger saw another actor play on stage in 1902. It's why Ray Bolger became an actor. He saw that performance as the Scarecrow and said, could I please play the Scarecrow? Buddy Ebsen then plays the Tin Man and gets sick because of the aluminum dust
in his
critical
makeup,
and he's out.
And also, Ray Bolger was the highest paid of all of the main performers because of the nature of studio contracts at the time. It's not like it is today, where you're negotiating on a picture by picture basis. You were paid what you were paid a week. So Judy Garland made very little. I mean, I think Toto is the only Terry was the only other person paid less than Dorothy in terms of the core stars of the film.
Let's talk about some of these other iconic moments too, and things that have been with us in our minds and imaginations. You know, Munchkins are with us since 1939 at least.
We represent the Lollipop Guild, the Lollipop Guild, the Lollipop Guild, and in the name of the Lollipop Guild, we wish to welcome you to Munchkin Land. We welcome you to Munchkin Land. La 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 la. From now on, you'll be history.
You'll be history.
You'll be history.
You'll be history.
And we will glorify your name.
You'll be a bus.
You'll bus.
Be a bus.
In the Hall of Fame.
Clip from the 1939 movie, The Wizard of Oz. We're looking at this movie 80 years after it was released, with Marsha Gordon and Laura Boyce. You know, it's a musical, but when you think about the textures and the variety of voices that you hear, it's not like a lot of other musicals, is it?
No.
And it's also not a backstage musical, which most of them were at the time. I mean, it predates things like Oklahoma, which was supposed to be transformative, of moving the story ahead with the songs, that they were integral to the action. And I also wanted to mention that another thing that's so wonderful about Oz are the fantastic costumes, which were done by Adrian, who was the studio designer at the time. And often designers would pass off lesser costumes to their assistants, but Adrian designed every single Munchkin himself, the flying monkeys, everything. He took complete responsibility for the costume look of the film.
Yeah, but the Tin Man nearly killed Buddy Ebsen.
Well, he was and not Bert in charge for formulating Lahr, the makeup.
All right, and Bert Lahr apparently still had lines on his face, like for the rest of his life, from the mask from the lion.
Oh, come on!
No, it's a true thing.
It's in the internet.
It's on this piece of paper in front of me. That's got to be true.
Well, you know, there are very few films in the history of cinema that have as iconic costume references as this film. Yeah. I mean, you know them instantly. Again, even if you haven't seen the film. But I do want to say something about the music. One of the things I like about this as a musical, Laura pointed out that it's an integrated musical, so the numbers are just peppered throughout. Some of them are so short. They're all so catchy. I mean, how many people know, you know, at least half of the lyrics from this film? And so
I mean, how many times have we sung Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead at a political moment?
Or just around the office. You never know. Harold Arlen, speaking of the music, Harold Arlen, who wrote the music to all the great songs in this movie, a Buffalo guy, born in Buffalo.
Yay.
Started a band called the Buffalodians. And before that, you should know, his first band was Hyman Arlick's Snappy Trio. That's what we did in Buffalo back in the turn of the century.
Were you in a Snappy Trio in your youth?
I was with him. I played the ocarina. But listen, tell me, talk about your favorite moment in this film.
So my favorite thing is when Bert Lahr sings When I Was King of the Forest. And part of the reason that... one author speculated this film resonated so much with people of the baby boom generation was because we did not know the vaudeville shtick that all of these players did. Like, if you see another movie with Bert Lahr, I mean, he goes, nar, 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 nar. I mean, that was his thing. Uh-huh. But I had never seen it until he did it as the lion.
I were king of the forest, not queen, not duke, not prince. My regal robes of the forest would be satin, a knot of a cotton, a knot chintz. I'd command each thing, be it fish or fowl, with a woof and a woof. And a royal growl. As I'd click my heel, all the trees would kneel, and the mountains bow, and the bulls kowtow. And the sparrow would take wing.
Here we go. Bert Lahr is the Cowardly Lion.
What great rhymes. I love the rhymes in that song so much.
You know, when I rewatched this recently, Bert Lahr has the best lines in the whole film. They are. He got the best lines. Yeah. They're the funny, punny kind of New York wit lines.
Yeah.
And he just gets them all.
Yeah. And as you say, reprising this kind of vaudevillian thing. We've got an email from a listener who said that they had an economics professor in college who would do class in the voices of all the characters of The Wizard of Oz. It made this listener love both the movie and economics, apparently.
I could have used that kind of economics professor, that's for sure.
Hello, my name is Charles Powell. I'm calling from Durham. And it's a reference to your show about movies. And I thought it was pretty interesting that you want to talk about The Wizard of Oz. And I have some great memories when I was a child of The Wizard of Oz. It was like a holiday. It was something really special. All the kids looked forward to it. We only had three stations at the time, plus public TV. That was a weird station. And it was just a really, really big deal. I think it aired every fall. And we were talking about it like the fair was coming. And very interestingly, some friends of mine from Living Arts in Durham invited me to a screening of The Wizard of Oz where they sync the album Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd, and it actually worked. It was so coincidental or whatever, it just really, really worked. And it was a lot of fun.
You knew this moment was coming. You knew this moment was coming.
I am going to do this right away. This is what I'm doing tonight.
You're going to sync that. So for those of you who don't know, if you start Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon on the third roar of the MGM Lion at the start of the film, it then, and turn down the sound for the film, there's just this beautiful way in which the album syncs. And by the way, it's best to do it with a CD. I know you love your vinyl. But if you do it with a CD, well, because you want it to repeat. The album isn't that long, and it will repeat. And even on the third and second and third runs of the album, it remains in sync with the movie, so they say.
Live and learn.
Well, there's some synchronicity. I think the best line was the drummer of Pink Floyd who said, "Absolute nonsense. It was the Sound of Music." That we did this to. Well, you know, you can imagine doing that to almost any film, but apparently there's a whole universe of people who've made this a cottage industry.
Well, you know what I like about what Charles just said? This is something we have lost, and young people, this is just something you can't experience, which is when something comes on television once a year, the excitement of deferral, and it's coming, and everyone's planning around it. I mean, that is an amazing thing to experience. And we live in such a time of immediacy, and if you want it, you get it right now. And that's gone.
Hey, talk about, Marcia, the relationship between Dorothy, this film, and the LGBTQ community. Long-standing relationship.
Yeah, so this has been a long-standing film that has been loved by people in the gay community, and Dorothy in particular has been an iconic figure, and I was very glad to hear that we had some callers who wanted to talk about that.
My name is Kevin Lewis, and from Carthage. The Wizard of Oz had a big effect on the gay community, as you know. And I think it had to do with the fact that everybody was outsiders in those movies. As Wicked brought out, the Wicked Witch was an outsider against her good sister, Glenda. Dorothy was an outsider in Kansas, and the Tin Man and the Scarecrow and the Lion, all outsiders. I think, and even the Wizard had to hide behind a curtain to be the Wizard, and he wasn't a Wizard. It was about outsiders who banded together. I mean, and fought the world. I mean, it's can you think of four more intrepid figures than the going down the Yellow Brick Road than the Lion, the Scarecrow, and the Tin Man, and Dorothy, and Toto?
It's Kevin Lewis talking about maybe why, but you know, it's interesting. I want to play another clip right now, and then we can come back.
Okay.
This is Tim Kirkman, who has an even more innocent view, and it's kind of interesting to think about this film without the overlay, without the filter that has since been attracted and accreted to this film.
My name's Tim Kirkman. I'm calling from Los Angeles, and I saw The Wizard of Oz for the first time when I was a kid, and it was my introduction to Judy Garland as a performer and an actor. And what I remember most is my obsession. From the earliest memories that I have watching The Wizard of Oz, I was obsessed with not only the movie, but I became obsessed with her. And I remember going to the public library in my tiny little rural North Carolina town and asking the librarian for all of the books, all of the biographies, rather, about Judy Garland. And I remember she said to me, "Oh, honey, you don't want to read about her life. It was so sad." And I said, "Yes, I do." And I have no explanation for that, except that as we all know, Judy became a gay icon. And one of the funny things about that is, like, I have no explanation for it as this little gay kid growing up in rural North Carolina, except to say that there's something about her that spoke to me and clearly to generations of gay men who heard her voice and saw her perform over the years. There was no adult gay person saying, "Here's a person you need to pay attention to as a young gay man." I knew it when I was six, so there's clearly something deeper at work with this particular performer, and I think for many of us, The Wizard of Oz is our introduction.
What do you think, Marcia?
I think those are both wonderful perspectives to have on this film, and you know, it makes me think, as Tim was talking, that I never really thought about it in this way before. Dorothy is so open. and accepting of like everyone, right, that she encounters. It doesn't matter who they are, how defect. I mean, she just is like, yeah, come, let's work together on this. And so I think that that might have something to do with it as well, that she's, you know.
Yeah, and she's not naive. She notices their difference, and sometimes it's startling to her. She's taken aback, but as you say, then she opens to it rather than sort of wants to shoot it.
Yeah, and yeah, let's come yeah. together and yeah. create this community.
And there's also that whole thing, there's no place like home. Well, if you feel like you're an outsider, your real home isn't the place that other people might define your home as being. You need to escape and create a different home in another place because, you know, your traditional home is just not comforting.
And even if you go back to Kansas and that is your home, you're forever transformed because of your experience.
That's right. And singing, when Judy Garland sings Over the Rainbow, it really brings me to tears, I think, more now even than before, because her performance is just so vulnerable and, like you say, so open. And that particular sequence was actually directed by a different director, King Vidor. And there's just something about this that makes you want to protect her.
Yeah. Well, and I will say this does bring me to something that disturbs me a little bit about the film, which is that I do think that one of the great tricks that it achieves is that it manages to make us forget the reality of Dorothy's world, which is pretty terrible. I mean, the day after this film ends, her dog is going to be taken away and murdered, right? I mean, she's still living on a farm, falling into pigsties. There's no, I mean, the film makes us believe there's no place like home, but really, it's not the best place.
But maybe she's found another solution.
We'll resolve this when we come back. The Wizard of Oz at 80 on Movies on the Radio. There's more to come. Stay tuned.
Why, oh, why can't I
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the Radio today celebrating the 80th anniversary of the film The Wizard of Oz. Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon with me to talk about this beloved film and your memories of it. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and the curator of the Movie Diva series. Marcia is a film professor at NC State and a fellow at the National Humanities Center. And we're also going to talk with an expert on L. Frank Baum, and who is author of the book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, a book that inspired the movie, of course, and it was a book that at least one listener thought was better than the film.
This is Chris Chato from Durham, North Carolina. And when I was a child, The Wizard of Oz was my very, very favorite book. Not only that, Frank Baum wrote, I think it's 14 other ones as well, and I collected them all. And then his niece went and she wrote a whole bunch, but these books were out of print, so I had to look for them, and it was really hard to get. But anyway, then I finally saw the movie, still as a child, but I was very furious because Judy Garland was much too old to play the part. The whole point is it's about a young girl, not a teenager. And secondly, and most importantly, is they made The Land of Oz all be her dream. Now, for children, the whole point of a fantasy book is that it's real. These things are real and magical. They're not only adults would think to make it to be a fake.
Dorothy, Dorothy, dear. It's Aunt Em, darling.
Oh, Aunt Em, it's you.
Yes, darling.
Hello there. Anybody home? I just dropped by because I heard the little girl got caught in the big... Well, she seems all right now.
Yeah, she got quite a bump on the head. We kind of thought there for a minute she was going to leave us.
Oh.
But I did leave you, Uncle Henry. That's just the trouble. And I tried to get back for days and days.
There, there, lie quiet now. You just had a bad dream.
Sure. Remember me?
Your old pal, Hunk?
Oh.
Me? Hickory?
You couldn't forget my face, could you?
But it wasn't a dream. It was a place. And you, and you, and you, and you were there.
Oh,
there you go. But that is not how the book ends, and Michael Patrick Hearn can tell you about that. He's a literary scholar who specializes in children's literature and the life of L. Frank Baum, and he joins us now. Michael, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us a little bit about L. Frank Baum, the author of the book that inspired the movie.
Oh, where to begin? L. Frank Baum was born in 1856, died in 1919. In fact, the day that he died, May 6th, is actually the day that the Wicked Witch dies, the Wicked Witch of the East dies, according to the coroner's death certificate. But Baum was born in central New York, in a little town called Chittenango, where they now have an annual Ozfest. And his father was a barrel maker. And he, there was the need for barrels in Pennsylvania oil industry, the early Pennsylvania oil industry, and his father became very wealthy because of that. And L. Frank Baum grew up in a very wealthy family. And like his father, he made fortunes and lost fortunes. He was involved in so many different things from the time, from his early 20s. He sold axle grease. He sold crockery on the road. He was a playwright. He raised fancy chickens. By the time he was 44, he published The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and he had quite a checkered career up to that point.
We'll talk about how that came about, because apparently he wasn't prepared to publish these. He'd been telling these stories for a while, and the people kept suggesting, you need to get these things in print, right?
Well, the person who got him to write down the stories he was telling his sons, he had four sons. There was no Dorothy in his life. Was his mother-in-law, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who was one of the great 19th century feminists, who wrote The History of Woman Suffrage, and then she has been written out of feminist history. And she had an enormous impact on Baum, and she overheard him one night, and she said, you're a darn fool if you don't write these down, try and sell them. And that was really the beginning of his career as a children's book writer.
Yeah, and it is interesting, because he's known if he has any political ideology at all, feminism is one of the ideologies that he is associated with. Talk more about that. I mean, how do we know that? Is that just from reading the book, or what else has he written to tell us that that's something that was important to him?
Well, if you look at the structure of Oz that he creates in The Land of Oz, the second Oz book, is the Scarecrow is deposed by General Ginger and her army of revolt, and General Ginger claims that she's Queen of Oz. Then Glinda conquers her and puts the rightful ruler of Oz, and that is Ozma of Oz, a little girl. And from then on, the Oz becomes a matriarchy. But the other thing that's interesting, too, is Baum probably introduced the first trans character in children's literature. This is going to be a spoiler alert. In the second Oz book, The Land of Oz, the hero of the book is named Tip, a little boy who has been raised by an evil witch called Mombi. It turns out that Mombi had transformed Princess Ozma into Tip. So at the end of the book, Tip is transformed back into his correct form, and that's Princess Ozma. So I think one thing that Baum was trying to point out is that Ozma has both a male and female characteristics. She's been living as a boy, and now she has become a girl.
Well, and this idea of the good witch, too, which I think had been abroad somewhat, especially in the 19th century, this idea had been revived a little bit or is in a little better currency. But it certainly makes, it's certainly a very important part of the film. Let's listen.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who, me? I'm not a witch at all. I'm Dorothy Gale from Kansas.
Oh. Well, is that the witch?
Oh, Toto? Toto's my dog.
Well, I'm a little muddled. The Munchkins call me because a new witch has just dropped a house on the Wicked Witch of the East. And there's the house, and here you are. And that's all that's left of the Wicked Witch of the East. The Munchkins want to know is, are you a good witch or a bad witch?
But I've already told you, I'm not a witch at all. Witches are old and ugly. What was that?
The Munchkins. They're laughing because I am a witch. I'm Glinda, the Witch of the North.
You are? Oh, I beg your pardon, but I've never heard of a beautiful witch before.
Only bad witches are ugly. The Munchkins are happy because you have freed them from the Wicked Witch of the East.
Oh, but if you please, what are Munchkins?
The little people who live in this land. It's Munchkin Land, and you are their national heroine, my dear.
There's a clip from the film, The Wizard of Oz, celebrating the film's 80th anniversary on Movies on the Radio with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies, and literary scholar Michael Patrick Hearn is with us as well, an expert on L. Frank Baum. So what was the, I mean, this, he does turn the trope of the evil witch, the crone, the ugly crone on its head in this book. How unique was that? How, you know, upsetting was that?
Well, actually, there are two good witches in the book, as there are two wicked witches. Glinda is actually the Good Witch of the South, not the North. That was MGM changed it. They combined the Good Witch of the North with the Good Witch of the South, but there are actually two that Dorothy encounters in the book. And I think Baum got the idea from his mother-in-law's book, a radical treatise called Woman, Church, and State, in which he took exception to how women had been treated by, in particular, the Catholic Church. And so she also attacked the persecution of witches. She said that a witch is just a wise woman, and she can be either good or evil, depending upon how she uses her knowledge, that there really was no intrinsic difference. It's how you use your knowledge, your science. And Baum certainly used that same theory in The Wizard of Oz.
You know, this is a question for Laura and Marcia to imagine some of these ideas. We've talked about the outsider and how this film has resonated over the years with, you know, communities that feel on the outside of social order. In 1939, how do you suppose this might have been taken? Or would we have seen all of this in the film in 39? Were people talking about that in 39?
I don't know how to answer that question, but I will say this. I do think that message of you are who you believe you are is very clear from watching the film. I mean, that's the whole trope with the wizard endowing these, you know, these tokens of people's, you know, courage and, you know, ability to think and so on. And I think that applies to the scenario of the witches as well. I mean, the Wicked Witch embraces her wickedness in this film in the same way that the Good Witch embraces her goodness.
Well, she's on a quest, too, to get those slippers,
right? That's right.
So they're all on a mission.
Well, also, one thing that's interesting about the book is that the Wizard of Oz and the witches, they're respected or they're feared, but they're not worshipped. So there's not any sort of a religious sort of overview of the whole Land of Oz.
Well, and in fact, if you want to take that to another extreme, if you think about what happens with the wizard in that great moment of unveiling him and the debunking of who he is, that he's just smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
He has no special powers. It's just what people believe him to be.
Well, and it's always struck me, and it was always one of the things that disturbed me about the film, and I want to talk to you, Michael, a little bit about how the book represents the wizard, because the fact that he is the one who ultimately, through his hucksterism, right, and his salesmanship, talks these folks into, you know, coming into the fullness of their lives, it's like, well, wait a minute. And it's kind of like, oh, we could either find out who we really are, or, and then I thought, well, this is the salesman for social media, or just create a Facebook persona and become that thing, you know,
he would have tweeted.
He would have tweeted, and you can create a whole fake persona, which doesn't require that you sort of get deep into yourself, which was the moment that we could have had. And how does the book represent him, the wizard? He comes off as kind of a slimy character, but a little bit heroic.
Benign charlatan.
A benign charlatan.
Well, he says, you know, I'm not a good wizard. I'm just a good man. In other words, that there's nothing. I mean, he's just been pretending all along that he was a great wizard, and people believed him. You know, as long as you tell the big lie, everyone will believe it. And it's a little girl who exposes him when she finally confronts him with, obeying fulfilling the promises that he's made to her. And I think it's also significant that the real power in Oz is with the women, not mm-hmm. with the men. It's the Good Witch and the Wicked Witch. Both of them have power. And then it's a little girl, Dorothy, who goes out and exposes the wizard as a fraud. And I think it's also important that I know that Ms. Magazine, I think it was in its first issue, they published stories for free children. And the earliest one was The Wizard of Oz, because Dorothy goes out, solves her problem. She doesn't depend upon some prince to come. She doesn't marry at the end. And one reason Little Women was not included was because at the end she ends up with Professor Bear. They thought that was
Yuck.
A compromise in those days.
That ruins
exactly.
the whole book.
Exactly. Well,
but I
Professor
wanna,
was actually her father. But anyway, we won't go into that.
But I want to throw this out, Michael, because, well, and everyone, because in point of fact, Dorothy doesn't really do all that much. She's kind of a follower, right? She's told follow the yellow
the
brick
movie.
Road. In the movie.
That's
I'm talking
the
about the movie. Exactly.
That's the movie,
exactly.
Not the book.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, I think a key scene in the film is the destruction of the Wicked Witch. How is that done? In the book, Dorothy loses her temper and douses her with a bucket of water that she's been forced to use to scrub the floors. In the movie, Dorothy throws the bucket of water on the scarecrow who the witch has set aflame. And by accident, the Wicked Witch gets doused in the puss. But in the book, Dorothy is much more assertive than she is in the movie. She doesn't go around crying all the time like Judy Garland
Somebody
does.
Always
a very
helps that girl.
Well, and she can, what you're saying is she can lean into her anger. She doesn't have to run away from it. So the trope of the angry woman, which is something that, you know, women have been forced to run away from because of the social,
And it's a very important point in children's literature. When Dorothy is allowed to lose her temper and she's not punished. In any other children's book, in American literature before that, she would have been spanked. She would have been sent to bed without her supper. Something would have happened to her. She destroys the Wicked Witch and she frees the Winkies.
I love that.
And I mean, it's an incredibly liberating story. And I think that's one reason why it's been so popular. It's so liberating for children that they can take control of their situation, no matter how horrible it is, and then, you know, and basically triumph in life.
How was he able to sustain, do you think, that the power of that book in the, because he wrote, what, 13, at least 13 others?
Yes, and then he wrote many other stories besides that, not just Oz books. He was incredibly prolific. He was also Suzanne Metcalf and Edith Van Dyne. There was a feminist writer mentioned to me and said he probably was the first American writer to use a woman's pseudonym. I mean, he was far ahead of his time.
Now, there's also, and we don't have time to get into all of this, but there's also a lot of thought about or talk about whether or not he was, you know, sort of pro-free silver and that this was all an allegory about a larger political...
He wasn't. He was a Republican. He was a Lincoln Republican, Teddy Roosevelt Republican. And in fact, he wrote a poem in favor of the gold standard McKinley in 1896. And then during the 1900 the big issue that year was the silver issue. Bimetallism, the gold standard, not one single reviewer found anything in The Wizard of Oz reflecting that particular issue. And this was it was published in the fall of 1900 during the height of the campaign. And there's absolutely no indication that Baum believed in that.
What does it say about the power of that book, that it was immediately adapted for stage and then became so many films? How unusual was that, or was it common for children's
Well, for a children's book, for certainly an American children's book, it was the most successful musical comedy of its day. It was sort of like The Wicked of 1902, 1903, 1904, 1905. And it's sort of been Broadway proof because, first of all, there was The Wizard of Oz in 1903 when it opened the Majestic Theater. Then, of course, The Wiz in the 1970s and now Wicked on Broadway with its phenomenal run. I mean, it's something that really captures the imagination. Also, they're very lucky that they had very strong production. And also, it brought spectacle back to the American theater.
Michael Patrick Hearn, literary scholar who specializes in children's literature and the life of L. Frank Baum. Thank you so much for being with us, Michael.
Thank you, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Next month, you're going to be talking about... we will be talking in this show about your favorite line of dialogue from a film, your favorite one-liner, most memorable moment in the film. Send us your pick at sot@wnc.org or tweet at us at #SOTMovie. Laura Boys, a couple of screenings coming up, some like it hot at the Carolina Theater in Durham, Wednesday, September 4th at 7. The Killer is going to be at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh at 2 p.m.
Yes, the North Carolina Museum of Art is switching all film screenings to 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. And this film stars Ava Gardner. We're going to have a pop-up exhibit from the Ava Gardner Museum.
Cool.
So please come.
North Carolina's own
Ava Gardner.
Great
Town
stuff.
Girl.
Thank you so much. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnuson, Grant Hollab-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.